Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
On the show this week is Jed Kahane, Director of News and Public Affairs at CTV Montreal. Jed talks about all aspects of his career in broadcasting, especially what it was like to cover big international stories like 9/11, as well as reporting on issues that are important to your local community. We then speak with our almost mother of the year, Casey Savage, on the experience of having to drive a minivan once your family surpasses three kids. We also reflect on the life and death of Whitney Houston, and Gina Lee of The Love Zone is here talking about aphrodisiacs.
Capture your need for sound.
Someone who specializes in keeping people up to date in their community is Jed Kahane, an award-winning journalist who is currently the Director of News and Public Affairs for CTV Montreal, a legendary local television station tied to the national media in Canada. Jed, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me.
Jed, have you always wanted to work in the news media? Was it a childhood dream of yours?
I don't think I knew it was a dream, but I was a very avid radio listener when I was young, and especially listening to the CBC as the documentaries took me around the world and just fascinated me. And when I was in university, not knowing too much what I wanted to do, studying politics, a friend asked me if I wanted to work on his radio show, which was a current affairs show on CKUT Radio McGill. And I did it, and I loved it, and I ended up learning how to do news there and translated that into a career in the media. But I didn't know at the time that that would be my career, but I guess I just slowly gravitated towards it, and pretty happy I did.
And when you were on radio, did you have intentions that you would move over to the television side of things?
No, it just happened that way. I learned enough at McGill Radio to get one of those, you know, graveyard shift overnight jobs at a local radio station writing the news for the morning show, and that station ended up closing and ended up getting an entry-level job in television. And you know, they're very different mediums in a lot of ways, but I ended up enjoying learning the ropes of television and the power of images. Originally I thought I would always work in radio, but just kind of ended up moving that way. A fork in the road, I turned one way and ended up staying in it.
Was it a different beast when you went to radio to television? Because I know a lot of times, like, there's this, I guess, underlying thought that it's easier to go from radio to TV than TV to radio. Do you subscribe to that sort of thought process?
I mean, the thing about television is it's so complicated logistically to get all those things together, all the editing, all the pictures, finding the opportunities for things that are visually compelling, that in a lot of ways you don't end up spending as much time doing the journalism as you would most of all in print, and then less so in radio. I always like the simplicity of radio, you know, just the voice and just the words, because I'm very into words. And, you know, but TV has the audience that is immense, so if you want your work to be seen and have an influence potentially, then television's a pretty great place to be. And then, you know, on those big stories that are visually very compelling and not a boring economy story, you know, the power of the images, you get really hooked on that and what you can do with creative storytelling and fantastic pictures.
Now, as you launched into your career as a reporter, what was the most challenging aspect of becoming a reporter and while you were sort of learning on the job? Because I think a lot of us that are in media end up having to learn while you're out there.
That's a funny question, because for me, the problem was getting over my nerves. I was an extremely shy person, and I probably got into the media as a way of forcing myself to get over my debilitating shyness as a young adult. And I remember the first time I went on CBC on television with Dennis Trudeau, who was the anchor at CBC, and I froze live on the air, and he had to say, "Jed, calm down, it's okay." And I can't believe they kept me on the air after that, but slowly and progressively, I got over it. And, you know, that's been one of the great things for me, because, you know, I learned that I had abilities I didn't know I had. That was the biggest obvious challenge for me, is that I was totally petrified, and I'm not anymore. So that really stands out.
Is there a big difference, you know, as you were reporting locally as opposed to nationally? Because I'm wondering if there's different skill sets when you're doing local reporting as to national reporting.
Not really. I mean, you just have to frame things a little differently depending on who your audience is. If you're talking to a room full of your neighbors, you'll say one thing. If you're talking to the entire city of Montreal, you'll say another. And if you're talking to a national audience, you can't take certain assumptions or historical knowledge for granted, and you have to spell it out. So a good example of that is explaining Quebec to the rest of Canada when I was a national reporter at CTV or at CBC covering the 1995 referendum or elections or language wars or the PQ, the Parti Québécois, you really have to frame things differently in order to make sure that people understand what's going on. Whereas if you're just broadcasting in Montreal, most people know essentially what the lay of the land is. So that kind of thing. Otherwise, the basic skills of finding the information, building the sources, getting it right, and trying to tell a story that's also interesting to listen to or to watch, those are the same no matter where you are.
Joining us on the show is Jed Kahane, Director of News and Public Affairs for CTV Montreal. Make sure to check it out, ctvmontreal.ca. Jed, as a reporter, you've covered some major stories, including the school shooting at Columbine, as well as 9/11. Did any of these major stories change you as a person, and even how you reported on crises like these as you went forward from those two?
I mean, I think the thing that you come back from those incredible breaking news stories, natural disasters, major human tragedies, is you're always struck in the end, despite the horror of it, by the humanity of the people who are caught in it. So to be able to see, you know, a community rally together, New York City pull together, the people in New Orleans help each other get out of the muck of Hurricane Katrina, despite their own suffering, you know, that's always been what I come back with, and probably what keeps you sane, actually, when you see a lot of horrific things like that in your reporting days. It's that ultimately, you know, there's a lot of goodness that is inspired in those tragedies, and you get to witness it.
Now, I'm not sure how long you were covering 9/11 or, you know, Hurricane Katrina, but when you were in those specific locations and you would sort of wrap for the day, how would you sort of take yourself down a notch? Because I'm sure you're in the moment, adrenaline, and it's overwhelming, I think, some of the things that you probably saw.
Yeah, I mean, some people are very affected by it, and post-traumatic stress disorder among journalists is now a well-studied and well-known phenomenon. I never had a big problem with it, I think probably because I talk a lot to people about how I'm feeling, which I guess for anyone who witnesses tragedy, I mean, I didn't experience the tragedy personally, so actually I had it pretty easy. It's the people who have to go through it who are most traumatized, but you do see a lot of horrific things. For example, in New Orleans, you know, going down what used to be a street in a boat and there's bodies floating everywhere, you know, that sticks with you and you have nightmares about it. But if you have a good support system around you and you get it out once the bad dreams fade, I find I've generally been okay. I know people who have been through similar experiences and not been, and it just really depends on the person and their constitution. I'm lucky. I'm not proud that I got through it, you know, without needing therapy, but I certainly consider myself lucky that whatever tools I have to keep myself thinking clearly. You know, on every big story like that that you cover, you're just so in the middle of it. Like you said, the adrenaline, you know, sometimes you're going 20 hours a day, you know, for a week on end, for example, just constantly serving the All News Network and the national news and then the morning show and the radio. It doesn't hit you. And then there's always one little thing that just in the middle of it or right after, just some little gesture by someone, and then you just lose it. That always happens on all those stories. And I can remember on every story I was on, you know, what the moment was where I just, you know, I realized what I was seeing and had to take a real break. But then you got to get back at it because there's 17 different people calling you from Toronto who need you on the air now. So, you know, it's not any different than being an emergency room doctor or an ambulance technician or, you know, that's a lot harder, really. But you see stuff and you just get the job done and you deal with it after.
When did you decide to leave reporting and move behind the scenes? And was it a tough decision for you to change and to not be on air anymore?
Well, there were two reasons. One is that my son drew a picture of the family and I was standing a little off to the side from the other four of them. And I, you know, it's a very exciting job and a very rewarding job and a fascinating job, but it requires you to be away at all hours at all times and with very little notice. And I have three young children who I wanted to spend a little more time with. And the other is that those big stories that we talk about, and a lot of other important stories, still keep you interested, but a lot of stories start to come around again and again and again, you know, whether it's the big snowstorm or the court case about murder X or murder Y, and, you know, looking for a new challenge. So helping to, you know, running a newsroom allows you to, you know, deal with the more interesting editorial issues while at the same time, you know, developing a staff, developing a journalistic vision for a newsroom and stuff that I always found fascinating, but wanted to learn a lot more about. So it's been a good move for me, both personally and professionally, and hopefully the staff agrees.
And do you miss, Jed, though, being out when it's like a big story? Do you miss being out there with the rest of reporters?
Yeah, when I see something that I would really sink my teeth into, whether it's a big story internationally or here in Canada or Montreal, or just something that I think I could do a good job covering, you know, where there's some injustice or something that I'd like to be digging into to try and make a difference. I still do that in this job, but there's a feeling of being out there in the field and chasing down a story that I do miss, but not enough to go back to it at this point.
I understand you've been a bureau chief for both, you know, here in Montreal and also in Alberta. What were your responsibilities as a bureau chief?
Well, when you have a bureau like the one in Montreal that when I came back to it had 5 people and previously had, I think, 10 people, the bureau chief is in charge of, you know, setting, you know, making decisions about the coverage, you know, dispatching resources, running budgets. So there's a bit of a staff to manage. In some bureaus, if you're the Asia bureau chief for CTV, I mean, you're the only guy, so it's really an honorific title. In Calgary, I was the only guy. I was the bureau chief by default because there was nobody else there except the cameraman. But it means that you're in charge of a very large area. And so you're not filing a story every single day because you've got to keep track of so many things. You've got to plan ahead. You've got to set up resources. So there's a lot to do other than just the journalism. And I'm always struck by that because we used to be owned by the same company as the Globe and Mail, Canada's number one national newspaper. And we would sit beside the print reporters from the Globe and Mail. And on any given story, while they went out into the field a lot, you know, as soon as something broke, we'd be out the door. Sometimes they'd just stay there all day and work the phone. So they could get so much more information because they didn't have to get from A to B, you know, find pictures, you know, get resources, go to a satellite truck and all this cumbersome stuff that TV reporters get saddled with. So they're very different professions. And to come back to your question, you know, a bureau chief has to do all that other stuff that you do in TV, and it takes up a lot of time.
Now, because I know you've moved away from being a bureau chief, now you're a director of news and public affairs for Montreal, for CTV Montreal. What are some of the responsibilities in this position for you?
Well, there's the overall direction of the editorial work that we do. So we do 2.5 hours of newscasting a day, 7 days a week. So we have a lot of editorial people, but ultimately, if there are decisions to be made or directions to be given, that falls to me. And then there's all the hiring of the staff, the development of our policies and our image and our look, and a lot of decisions along those lines. You know, administration, all the budgets and so on. We have a large budget and a large news team. So basically everything. It's a lot of fun because it's about a million different things every day. And I get to stick my fingers into all of it, and the stuff I really not that interested in I can hopefully delegate to someone else. But it's very interesting. And we, you know, the most amazing part of it is you get to have a responsibility for ensuring that, you know, in our case 85 people in the newsroom are, you know, working happily, productively, and producing work that's valuable to the public, which ultimately is what certainly drives me as a journalist.
Jed, what's a typical day like for you? Like, what would, if someone was looking at your life, what would they see you doing, like, sort of day to day?
It's my wife getting a little bit mad at me for picking up my iPhone at 6 in the morning and starting to read the papers and see what's going on in the world and firing off countless emails about editorial ideas of what we could be and should be doing. Then I'm in here with the news team going to all the editorial meetings. You know, some days I'll disappear for the entire day to go do budget meetings or to do job interviews with people who are applying to work here. Some days when news breaks, I'm out there like anyone else in the newsroom, you know, helping to write the show and making decisions about what we should air and how we should frame our stories. So it just runs the gamut. And, you know, the big difference from my old job is I'm usually out of here around 6 o'clock and the evenings are a little more calm than they used to be.
I wanted to ask you, if there is like a breaking news story like Katrina or, you know, a 9/11, or, you know, thankfully you haven't had something as big as that in North America, but if that is a weekend or whatever, are you in automatically for that?
For a really big story, I would be. I mean, we've got a, you know, on every shift, whether it's the weekend or the weekday, there are experienced editorial people who are in charge. So, you know, with the joy of modern technology, the joy and the pain of modern technology, they can reach me anytime about any questions. I'm constantly answering editorial questions that I can answer from the field, whether it's my home or somewhere else, I don't have to come in for everything. But of course, when there's a big story, whether it's an election or a big breaking story like an earthquake in Haiti or something where, you know, we just need more hands on deck, I'll come in at the drop of a hat if I can, and so will everyone else, you know. Whenever there's a big story, journalists always rush to the newsroom because they want to be involved in it. You know, they want to inform the public. They want, you know, the experience of being close to big events.
Joining us on the show this week is Jed Kane, Director of News and Public Affairs for CTV Montreal. Check them out, ctvmontreal.ca. Jed, it seems as the years go by, the news cycle spins faster and faster, not only here in Canada, but around the world. How do you keep focused and keep your team focused on reporting what is essential and not sort of getting into tabloid fodder or sensationalist?
Well, that is a big balancing act for us because there's the difference between what is important and meaningful and what's popular. And it's a fine line to walk, you know. How many stories do we do on Whitney Houston when she dies, and Britney Spears, or the dog that floated down the river on a log, or the YouTube video of something or other? There's an endless amount of that you can do. I think the idea is that you want to offer an overall news package that appeals to people broadly because it draws them in to watch the journalism that's important. And it also pays the bills for a private company like CTV. So it's a constant balancing act. I think it comes down to the commitment of people in the newsroom to fight the temptation to do what's easy and popular and try to do things that are meaningful. I think like any other newsroom, sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail. You know, I'm proud of the product we put on the air. And some of it is entertainment. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we have an entertainment reporter. That's not, you know, that's not economic news, and it's not the Eurozone crisis in Europe, but it's stuff that people care about and are interested in. So we tell them about it.
And what do you say, Jed, when you have a new reporter or someone who is maybe going to go to the next level? For example, you know, here in Montreal, we just had Todd Vanderhaeden move on to Toronto, and now you have Paul Krawatsky. Did you have to sort of have discussions with him to sort of get him ready to the next level? And again, what would you say to a new reporter that you would have sort of to take his place or someone else's place?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of discussions with Paul Krawatsky, who took our lead anchor job, and he's very young. Which is good in many ways because we want to attract younger viewers to stay with us. You know, our audience is aging, and it's important to build a new audience who want to see themselves reflected on our airwaves. I mean, Paul's a very good journalist despite his young years, so we talked a lot about how he would approach things, how he would, you know, be mature and serious on the air, but most of it he already knew, so it made my job pretty easy. For young journalists coming in, I mean, you know, I'm really strong on accuracy. You know, we don't tolerate mistakes, really. If you want to work here, you have to get it right and all the time. Everyone can make the occasional mistake, but not very many of them. I just think that's our biggest responsibility. There's so much information out there in the world today that what sets the traditional media apart, or if we want to set ourselves apart and not be replaced in my lifetime by YouTube and Twitter, we need to offer something that other people can't offer, and that's credibility, accuracy, reliability, fairness, and a level of news production that not everyone can offer. So I like working with journalists, you know, just in terms of their storytelling abilities. You know, there's a million ways to tell every story. What I love about being in the TV business is that there's a, you know, there's an approach to making things that aren't necessarily interesting, obviously, and maybe young people would rather watch much music, but if you tell your stories well and creatively, you can maybe draw them in when otherwise they might not.
And what do you say to a teenager or a young adult who actually wants to look towards a career in news media?
I tell them that the easy part of the job is doing the nuts and bolts of TV reporting or of journalism. It's not rocket science. What you need is knowledge about what you're covering. That's what sets people apart for me. I didn't study journalism, I studied political science, so maybe I know quite a bit about politics compared to someone who studied journalism. And I think the easier thing to pick up as a skill is how to turn knowledge into a television report or a radio report. What's difficult is how to understand the political landscape of Quebec or the economy if you know nothing about it. So if you really want to be a journalist, hopefully you're a curious person. So whether you're doing it as part of your formal studies or not, you got to learn about a lot of things. That's what sets people apart for me. And some of the best people I've hired are not, you know, traditional journalism graduates. They're people with a wide range of interests and knowledge and critical thinking abilities, that's really what makes a good journalist. And if you look over time, you know, the great journalists of our world were not, you know, people who studied journalism. They were just people who were really curious and had a good BS detectors and, you know, knew how to get to the bottom of the story.
What's your stance, I suppose, on interning? Because I myself was an intern at our local radio station here in Montreal, and I think that helped me immensely, apart from the fact that I did graduate from university in communications. What do you tell, like, a young person? Is interning and sort of learning the craft from that aspect as well important to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't see it at all as cheap labor. Interns, of course, are helpful to us because they can do some of the work, but that's not why we bring them in. It's part of developing, you know, helping people develop their professional skills. And from, you know, it's as much work to have an intern here because you have to train them on a lot of things they don't know. So it's not a cheap labor program for us. What I can say is that for people who are coming out of school and have the opportunity to intern, jump on it, because most of the people we hire here have interned here. Unless they're established journalists who come from elsewhere, the way to get yourself noticed outside the pack is to intern and stand out from the crowd. And, you know, even in my few years as news director, we've hired a dozen people who were interned here. And because if you intern and we like you, you'll get a little bit of work slowly. And the better you are, the more you'll stand out and you'll end up working. So it's really one of the few ways to get in the door. It's pretty hard to walk out of, say, university and just walk into a job, especially the way the media is these days, which is a little leaner than it used to be. Even though there are a lot of jobs out there still, if you can give yourself a leg up by proving yourself in person, absolutely do it.
Fantastic. Jed, thank you so much for joining us this week. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent. That is Director of News and Public Affairs for CTV Montreal, Jed Kahane. Check out their website, ctvmontreal.ca.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Last week on the Kelly Alexander Show, we honored the life of Whitney Houston. We spoke with her choreographer, Sean Cheeseman, who worked with her on the set of The Bodyguard back in 1992. And it was really interesting to learn what she was like as a person behind the scenes, and also how hard she worked at trying to do the best job she could on The Bodyguard because it was her first movie acting role. It was also fun to speak with Gray Drake, a movie critic for CNN and Fandango.com. She was able to bring back all these movie titles that Whitney had been in, and it was great to sort of reminisce about all the good work that Whitney had done during her film career. So it's been a bit of a crazy couple of weeks in the fact that Whitney has passed away. I think a lot of us music fans were devastated. I'm going to use that word because I think a lot of people, you know, even if you were not a big fan of Whitney, you couldn't deny the power and the passion that she had with her voice. And she was known as the voice. And I've never heard another singer like her as long as I've been alive. And even her sort of proteges, if you want to call it that, such as Jennifer Hudson, who looked up to her as a kid and who was a very powerful singer. She's amazing, but she just doesn't sound like Whitney. No one sounds like Whitney, which is fair because no one should sound like Whitney. No one should sound like Janet Jackson. No one should sound like, you know, Alicia Keys. Everybody sounds how they should, but no one really comes close to the power and the passion and the charisma that Whitney Houston had. So I think a lot of music fans are just very sad to see that another powerful pop star from the 80s and the 90s has passed away. It's been a rough couple of years, first losing Michael Jackson and now losing one of his friends, Whitney Houston. And it was very eerie in the fact that I watched a clip of Whitney Houston talking to Oprah just recently from when she did the interview with Oprah back in 2009. And it was interesting because in that interview, you know, Whitney was talking a lot about her life and her sort of situation with Bobby Brown. And it was interesting in the fact that even though she was talking about her own personal pain at many points with Oprah, the only real time I saw her get kind of weepy and upset is when she talked about the death of Michael Jackson and how much it hurt her and how much she was bothered by it. And the fact that, you know, his death was linked really to prescription drugs, even though I know he died from propofol. But it was all sort of tied together in the fact that he has been addicted or had been addicted to prescription medication for a long time and everything just sort of escalated. And it was kind of creepy to see her talk about that. And now, you know, 2.5 years later, it seems that this is the same reason that she passed away. Now, at the time of this recording, we don't have the official word what caused her death. But by all accounts, it's looking like it was a lethal dose of prescription drugs mixed with alcohol. And obviously, this is not something that she would have done consciously. It sounds like it was an accident, just like it happened with Heath Ledger. But if this does turn out to be true, this is just another tragic passing of a celebrity that didn't have to happen. And I really think that this year could have been Whitney's year for a comeback. And I hate that word because I really don't think it sort of fits the situation. But if we need to use a word, we'll use that word, comeback. I think that her movie that is going to be released in August called Sparkle would have really made people take notice of Whitney again. From all accounts, she did amazing on the set a couple of months ago. I actually saw interview footage of her talking to a reporter, and she was very into it. She was very excited. She looked great. She looked better than I've seen her in years. And it really felt like she was getting her feet on the right path and heading down the right road. And if you actually watched the funeral and you heard Clive Davis talk, which was her mentor and the guy who signed her to Arista back in the day, he said that she had gone to him and said that she was trying to turn her life around and trying to get herself ready. And, you know, she was really thinking that August was going to be her month, August of 2012. So it's bittersweet to know that she probably would have been on her way back. And the fact that I think we would have been enjoying her work yet again. But now the fact remains that Whitney Houston passed away at the age of 48 in Los Angeles. And something else that sort of comes to mind with all of this, because I think it's prickly and it's kind of under the surface, is Bobby Brown, her ex-husband. I know in the last couple of weeks, all I've heard from many people is, oh, that Bobby Brown, he's the one that brought her down into the depths of despair and you know, put her on this path of drug and addiction. And, you know, this is where she is because of him. And here's the thing. I am no fan of Bobby Brown. I used to really like him when I was a kid. I loved him in New Edition. I loved when he started his solo career. I thought he was, you know, amazing with My Prerogative and Every Little Step. But then he got into drugs and alcohol. And I think that his talent, he had a lot of it. He was an amazing dancer. He had a great voice. He had a bit of an edge to him. And it was something, you know, fun and funky in those 80s and 90s. But then he sort of went down the wrong path. And again, I'm no fan of what he did to himself. And I have often thought that he sort of brought Whitney down with him. And probably he did. But the fact remains is that Whitney has to be held accountable for what happened. Because no one forced her to shove whatever it was up her nose or down her throat or, you know, in her arm or whatever she was doing all those years. So the fact remains that, yes, I think that the two of them were toxic together. I don't think they helped each other. Even Whitney herself, you know, revealed to Oprah back in 2009 that they would sort of sit there on the couch just zonked out and zoned out because they were high as kites. And they were basically enabling each other. And you know, she had the money at that point because I don't think he had really any money. So they were probably spending all of her millions, you know, on these drugs. But they were basically enabling each other. And so the fact remains that, you know, Whitney, we all have to realize that Whitney has to take responsibility or should have taken responsibility for her situation. And if it does sort of turn out to be the fact that she passed away because of a mixture of prescription drugs and alcohol, well, she knew better. And I remember, again, watching a clip on this Oprah interview and she said to Oprah, yeah, I'm clean, but don't think I don't drink alcohol. And at the time of that Oprah interview, she didn't really make it sound like she drank a lot, but she's like, you know, I go to the clubs and I'm going to have a drink. She's like, don't come down on me if you see a picture of me in the clubs with a drink. And I think that, and then she sort of went on to say that, you know, I don't have a problem with drinking. It was always Bobby that had the problem with drinking. I never had a problem with drinking. Well, I think clearly she did have a problem with drinking. I think that any person who's addicted to anything in the drug realm and the alcohol realm shouldn't think that they're not going to be addicted to alcohol. If drugs was their problem and they claim that alcohol was not, really they should be staying away from that too because you have an addictive personality. And if you're not doing drugs, chances are you might just become addicted to alcohol. And I think that's what happened to Whitney. I think she let herself sort of fix the drug issue maybe with the cocaine or whatever she was doing. But she didn't sort of fix the alcohol. And I've seen some pictures of her from clubs and she does look inebriated. So I think that's part of the issue. So it's been rough. It's been rough to know that Whitney's no longer with us, especially because if she was trying to turn herself around, it would have been amazing to have her back. And I know apparently she was working hard on her voice, trying to get it back up to full power. And, you know, there's several singers, Tina Turner, for example, who is, you know, not a spring chicken, and she's out there still singing away and reaching notes, obviously not as high as Whitney can, but still doing her thing and kicking up her heels in her 70s. And I think that Whitney would have been able to do that as well had she fixed her life up and sort of pushed forward. So in all of this, I think it's a sad time for music fans. I am grateful, though, for everything she provided. She's provided so many fun songs and hit songs that have evoked a lot of emotion in people over the last, 20, 30 years that she was in the business. And so we have to be grateful for what she brought us. And my concern now is that I hope her daughter, Bobby Christina, gets the love and support from her family that she needs, and that she herself stays away from drugs and alcohol, because she grew up in a very volatile home and it would be very easy for her to sink down that path just like her parents. So I really hope that her aunts and uncles and cousins can support her through this, and especially her grandmother, who I know is like 78 years old and shouldn't have to be dealing with this. But I really hope that they can support each other, that Sissy Houston and Bobby Christina can be supportive of one another and they can push through this. And again, our thoughts and prayers from the Kelly Alexander Show going out to all of the friends and family and the fans of Whitney Houston.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
I am very excited to welcome back to the show our almost mother of the year, Casey Savage, who writes for her blog of the same name and who also appears regularly on the Home Shopping Network. Casey, thanks again for joining us on the show this week.
It's my pleasure. It's so good to speak with you in 2012.
Exactly. The last time we spoke was the holiday season, and now we have launched into 2012. And I know that our topic of conversation this particular time is going to revolve around transportation. In your case, family transportation. And so I have to ask you, Case, what does a mom of three boys get to drive around these days?
Wish I could give you a glamorous answer, but when you've got three plus children, your options are very limited. It is a van. I will come clean. I have to drive a van. It's completely going against my personal wishes, style, hopes, and dreams for myself. But in putting my family first, I drive around in a van full of kids, full of mums, full of pet hair, and we don't even have a dog, so I don't even know where that fur comes from, to be honest with you.
Okay.
That's a mystery.
You know, what is your view, or what was your view in the grand scheme regarding minivans, I guess, prior to you having a family?
Oh, just like bottom of the barrel. Like, honestly, like, let's face it, when you're young, you're going through university, you're out on your own, you're in the world, you're earning an income. Do you ever stop for a moment and say to yourself, When I really make it in this world, I want to own a van? No, you do not say that, okay? You don't. Unless it's a cargo van and you have your own landscaping business or something. There is no way that is on your list of things to own. That is not your aspiration. But when reality smacks you in the face, you have no other choice, then out of van shopping you go.
Okay. And so prior to, you having the family, did you actually have your own sort of solo car?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I sure did. I mean, I like some style. And it all started when I was 17. My dad my parents were just freshly divorced. My dad met a great woman, and she gave my brother and I her car, which at the time was a Cadillac Fleetwood d'Elegance. And I'd like to add the elegance part into that. It was a gold tone with a beautiful tan interior, leather, heated seats. It was a wide ride. Like, you could easily fit 7-8 people in that back seat, and I did. But, so I was accustomed to the good life, From a young age, I thought, we're only going up from here. We're only moving in the world.
So then comes marriage, and then comes children, and then one children, two children, three children.
Yeah, we had a regular car with two children. I actually kind of went partway to a van. I got the station wagon. It was a little Volvo station wagon. I thought this could still pass as cool because it's European.
Right.
But then there's just no way with three kids. They were all so young. You needed a car that would fit three car seats all in a row, and that just didn't exist. It just was not possible. And all those other SUV type of cars out there that have the third bench, I couldn't have a girl climbing over a second row seat to get into their car seat to have me buckle it up. It just wasn't practical. So I just had to suck it up and make my way over to the minivan dealership.
Did Brad, your husband, basically have to drag you over there to look at the minivans?
Well, truth be told, the moment I showed him that positive pregnancy test, I remember he threw a pillow over his face and moaned and groaned. It was pretty unpleasant, actually. And He wasn't expecting his third pregnancy, and I remember the first words he uttered were not, yay, congratulations, we're going to be parents again. The words he literally muttered underneath that pillow on his face were, we need a minivan. True story.
So he was almost more devastated than you.
Well, come on. That's like, to a man, it's almost like saying, would you like a vasectomy? Like, it's a chop away at your manhood. To
right.
get behind the wheel of a family wagon like that, it hurts the pride, but you've
okay.
got to do it.
Okay. And so what is it, I guess, about the whole minivan plan that had you repulsed? Was it the whole, because I know back when we were younger, the minivan was like the wood paneling. Was that the concern?
Well, the style, I mean, more specifically, the lack of. And then have you ever been in a van that smelled pleasant?
Right.
No. It does not, because so many unpleasant things happen in a large vehicle that's meant to hold a brood of children.
Mm-hmm.
Diaper leaks.
Oh.
Motion sickness.
Right.
Spilled food. Banana peels left underneath bench seating for years on end. I'm talking gruesome here. So absolutely horrible images in my mind. Of owning a van. And then I picture those ones your parents warned you about with the curtains and the teardrop windows. And there's just no good image of a van from my childhood. We didn't have a van. We did have a station wagon, but the station wagon seems like, you know, you go from car, station wagon, it's kind of like saying, I know I need a van, but I'm just not going to do it. And then the next step is van, where you're like, you know what, forget it. I'm not even combing my hair anymore. Just get me in a van.
Joining us on the show is Casey Savage, Almost Mother of the Year. Make sure to check her out at almostmotheroftheyear.blogspot.com. Now, Casey, when you finally convinced yourself to go to the dealership and slide behind the wheel, I guess, first of all, I should ask you, was there many brands of cars that you, or minivans that you had a plan to go check out? And once you sat behind any of these models, did your outlook change?
Yeah, we looked at pretty much everyone out there, and my reaction to them was all the same. Barf, pretty much. And then finally I came to grips with the fact that this was not an option. This was a necessity. So I'd better suck it up, get my act together, and just choose something. So we went to a Nissan dealership, and I got into the Nissan Quest. And at the time, there was a huge marketing campaign around this van, and they had all sorts of moms with red lipstick and stilettos in the TV ad. So I'll admit it, I fell victim to the advertising. I thought, okay, that could be me. I could wear a pencil skirt and drive a kid to soccer practice. It's doable. And I got inside, and I was pleasantly surprised. This big leathery bucket just wrapped itself around my bum and said, take me for a ride. I loved it. It was awesome.
And for those of us, you know, who haven't had to go to the route of driving a boat on wheels, what
I still can't work it, by the way.
What I guess sort of jazzy accoutrements do they have, the new, you know, minivans that could turn our fancy?
Oh, they've got everything. You know what would be the best? They've got pretty much everything under the sun these days, but what I think would be the best would be like one of those limousine-style windows that separates the driver from the passengers.
Right.
I would love that, because so often the kids are fighting in the back seats. So the way seating arrangements work, and I think all parents should consider this if they haven't already when they get it in, is you put the whiniest crier in the back row and the most pleasant kids up towards the front. Because you really want to drown out the whining, right? So you
right.
stick them as far back as possible. And with our van, that's probably a good, 8-10 feet from where I'm sitting. So if I just had that little plexiglass window that came up as kind of a noise blocker, as long as they've got their seatbelts on, I don't care what's happening back there. We just need to get where we are going. But otherwise, it's fully loaded. I love it.
And do they have the fancy drop-down DVD things?
It does. Unfortunately, my children are immune to external entertainment sources, so that absolutely does not work in
really?
Terms of quieting them down for a road trip. Someone's always talking over it. It's usually Spencer, the youngest. Then the other two are mad at him. Then someone cries that they don't want to watch that movie. So we rarely use that. Almost never. It's
wow,
not worth the hassle.
I thought
instead
that would
I play the old count the cows and count the horses.
Well, I'm proud of you, Case. I'm proud that you would go retro, you know what I mean, and count the cows.
I do that, you know, for roadkill, find a license plate with a Z in it, and play all sorts of games.
Now, I guess this question has a bit of a different take now that I'm going to ask you. Did the boys actually acclimate well to the van?
Well, they don't have any memory there to age two.
Okay.
That's when basically all of them somewhat moved to the van. So all they really remember is the van, and it's like their second home. Like when you're shuttling kids to and fro, they probably spend more time in the van on any given weekend than they do our actual house. I mean, they're always in it. They know how to operate it better than I do. Like they know where all the buttons are. They're opening and closing doors. Trunks are going up and down. Like they're very van savvy. I mean, I'm sure none of them want to inherit it as a 16-year-old with their driver's license, but they're very van savvy. This could bode well for when they have kids.
And I have to ask you, because you had to choose this van, you know, and it was obviously something that you didn't really want to do, but again, necessity. Did you actually get at least a funky color? Like, it's not champagne,
well,
is it?
Well, it's black. No, it's not champagne. Okay. It's not my Cadillac gold with tan interior.
Okay.
It's black, although it does have chrome roof racks, which are, it's got an element of bling. It's not Pimp My Ride, but it's not bare bones either.
Okay.
It needs a little customizing, to be honest. But right now, the only thing in Canadian winters that are on my van is excessive salt stains.
Right. All right. Now, do you have two cars so that sometimes, you know, you can forget that you're a mom with three boys and you know, you can actually just rock it down the road in something like sporty, like a sleek sedan or a sporty coupe?
Yes. My husband's car, which, well, let's face it, I pretend it's mine. Is a nice Infiniti. So I get in there, and I love the little perks that after you've been driving a van for a while, you forget that there are automobiles out there where you touch the gas pedal and it actually accelerates quickly. Like you lose that touch. So when I'm on the highway in my van, I can hit the gas and count to 50, and I still haven't passed the car in front of me. Like that, I've got a little cargo in there. So when I get in something by myself that weighs less than 8,000 pounds, I just go like stink. You can't even see me. I'm speeding. I've got windows open. I'm playing gangster rap. I'm living it up.
Does it have like mag wheels?
I don't even know. I haven't even looked at the wheels.
You don't care as long as
I'm
it's
just
going
excited.
Fast.
You know what it does have? It has one of those neat rear view screens where you see where you're backing up without actually straining your neck.
Right.
So often with the hairstyle I've got, it hurts to turn my head. So in the van, that poses a problem because I often bump into things. But this is great. This is my husband's car. You look at the screen. You can see if there's, you know, pets, people, whatever you're about to run over.
Nice.
Brake accordingly and just keep on.
And is Brad cool with you driving the sporty car?
Oh, yeah. He feels for me. He really does.
Okay. Now, I understand, you know, that you are on the lookout for some new wheels because, A, you've had them for a while, if I understand this, the minivan plan, you've had it for a while. And also, your oldest, Wyatt, is no longer needing to be in the car seat because he's now past the age and he's good to go, right?
Yes. He's past even the booster seat.
Oh, fantastic.
Very exciting. That honestly is one of the, you know, so many parents just want to see their kids graduate university or become a doctor. For me, it was getting out of that damned booster seat so that finally we can fit three kids in a row in something. That's all that mattered to me, and it's finally happened.
So this
so
is changing.
Exciting.
Okay, so things are changing. So what is the plan? Where are we going? Are we going back to a van? Is there like a station wagon at least, or what's happening?
Well, in my mind, I'm driving something sporty and fun.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is also mostly based on fantasy. But if I take it to a level of reality, I most probably will be driving another van.
I see. Now, are we going to stick with Nissan? Like, are you going to check some other things out?
Well, I'm open to being wooed by the various car companies if they've got something they want to show me, and I'll let them know where my address is. But I completely, I'm open to anything. I just want to see what's out there. There are so many innovations. Now they've got fun things in vans where the second row swivels so we can face the third row. And when I think about my kids fighting in the van, that'll be so much more practical for them to hit each other face on instead of trying to reach behind each other the whole time. So many benefits to the new designs out there.
And it's not that I want to burst your bubble, P.S., but I realize, because, you know, you did sort of acknowledge that you're probably going to have to go back to the minivan. And I guess my other point in that is that even though Wyatt has graduated from the booster seat and is now sort of free and easy, he's now in the age where I'm assuming that sporting activities could kick in, and especially as he's a good Canadian boy, potentially hockey, which means a large and massive hockey bag, which needs to go somewhere.
We do have to have a lot of stuff. That is true. That's another thing you've got to consider, right? I mean, you can convince yourself that you're never going on a family holiday, your kid will never play a sport, you will never own a pet, but chances are all of that will happen to you and you will need a van. It just happens. So right now I'm just trying to console myself. I'm thinking, you know what? It's not so bad. That's why they sell large sunglasses. One needs to know, right? They can't see me. I can't see them. We're good to go. And now that Wyatt's 8, I've already started looking forward to the fact that in 8 more years, he'll have a driver's license and he can drive his brothers around in the van.
Yes, that is a rite of passage, because I remember when I got mine, I was very thrilled. And then one of my first duties was to go buy milk. So that was
and then drive
my brother somewhere. Sorry? No, it was not a van. It was a sedan.
See, that's kind of mortifying for teenage boys. So I'm thinking this could keep them in check, driving the family minivan around town.
Yeah, because you don't have to give them daddy's car. You know what I'm saying?
That is not a lady magnet, although there is an awful lot of space in it.
So
I might have to reconsider.
And I want to ask your advice, because for new moms out there who may be on the cusp of having to, you know, give up their sleek and sassy ride, what do you want to tell them to prepare themselves for going the minivan route?
You know what? You drag your heels. You say it'll never happen. It's like anything else in life. You claim it'll never happen. I'll never do that. I'll never try that. And the next thing you know, there you are at that red light. You look over. There's that friend of yours in their convertible, living la vida loca. And you just do what I do. You pull down the visor, you flick it to the left, they can't see you, and you accelerate slowly.
I love it. Fantastic. Casey, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. Always a pleasure, as per usual.
It's so much fun, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
That's Casey Savage again, Almost Mother of the Year. Check her out on her blog, almostmotheroftheyear.blogspot.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. Sometimes it doesn't take much to get in the mood for love, but it doesn't hurt to take advantage of some natural aids that can help fan the flames higher. They say the way to a person's heart is through the stomach, so I'm going to explore some edible aphrodisiacs that you can use to whet the appetite for love. Shall I start with the most popular? I bet you can already guess what it is. Oysters. Yes, raw oysters have long been credited for increasing the libido, especially in men. They're very high in zinc, which raises sperm and testosterone production. So chuck a few of those bad boys down and it'll be on till dawn. Here's another classic aphrodisiac for you. Chocolate. Come Valentine's Day, all the stores will be stocked to the ceilings with boxes of these bonbons. Aside from it tasting good, there are a couple of chemicals that make chocolate sexy. It contains theobromine, a stimulating alkaloid similar to caffeine. Gets you going. Chocolate also helps the brain produce serotonin, the feel-good chemical that makes your toes curl in contentment. This may be why some people actually prefer having chocolate over sex. Remember, when it comes to chocolate, the darker, the better. Now, if sweets aren't your thing, there are a host of other edible aphrodisiacs to choose from, like asparagus. 17th century English herbalist Nicholas Culpepper wrote that asparagus stirs up lust in man and woman. Along with other great nutrients, asparagus contains folic acid, said to boost the histamine production necessary for reaching orgasm. So, see that you get those sexy spears on your plate. If veggies don't appeal to you, try some nuts. Almonds in particular. With their high levels of vitamin E and magnesium, Almonds can improve your mood and general well-being, which is always a turn-on. Now, let's not forget about fruits. Bananas are seen as an aphrodisiac and a symbol of fertility. Full of magnesium, potassium, and B vitamins, this phallic fruit contains the bromelain enzyme said to enhance the male libido. What do you call sliced bananas dipped in dark chocolate and sprinkled with slivered almonds? Three ways to heaven. Another fruit that's not as sweet but still sexy is the avocado. Associated with male sexuality, ancient Aztecs called the avocado tree ahuacuatil, or testicle tree, because of how pairs of the hanging fruit resembled, well, you know what. With a high content of folic acid, as well as vitamin B and potassium, avocados are also said to boost immune function. The creamy fruit also has a smooth texture that can be quite sensuous, so get cozy with your guacamole. There are many more aphrodisiacs out there, but I'll leave you with one final one. Raw egg yolks. High in vitamin B6 and B5, eggs help to balance hormone levels and fight stress. Raw egg yolks eaten before sex are considered to enhance one's libido. So if you've got a good control over your gag reflex, knock some back like Rocky Balboa and get in the bedroom. Bon appetit!
I'll come back. There is a way I'm leaving.
That's Beyonce with Love on Top, remixed by DJ Escape and Tony Coluccio on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, including Jed Kahane and Casey Savage. Next week, by the way, we speak with dietitian Kim Airy about whether fasting is really a good idea to curb degenerative brain diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Before I leave you, I want to let you know you can always reach me at kelly@kellyalexandershow.com if you have any comments or questions. And here is your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Greer Garson. Starting out to make money is the greatest mistake in life. Follow your passion, and if you are good enough at it, the money will come. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.